Hello and welcome.
Bienvenido.
你好.
And assalamu alaikum.
Welcome to AO Access to Success,
the podcast series developed by the AO Access Task Forces
to broaden your perspectives
for personal and professional development.
Today's podcast is hosted by Wail Hamouda, member of the AO Access Officer and Faculty Selection Processes Task Force.
Welcome to the AO Access to Success podcast, a platform dedicated to fostering diversity, equity, and inclusion in all facets of healthcare environments. Today, we delve into the clinical landscape, exploring gender-specific differences in health outcomes and treatment effectiveness. Join us as we analyze the impact of gender on patient care, uncovering insights to drive better healthcare practices and promote equitable treatment for all. My name is Wail Hamouda. I'm an associate professor of neurosurgery department at Cairo University Faculty of Medicine, Egypt, the same college where I graduated in 2002 and gained my doctorate degree in neurosurgery in 2010. And let's say I like traveling, that's why I undertook several fellowship abroad, two in Germany, one in Switzerland, and the last one was for pediatric neurosurgery at Harvard University Children's Hospital of Boston. And today with me, I have Dr. Rory Godwin and Mrs. Andrea Godwin. Dr. Rory Godwin is the Director for Spinal Oncology and is the Surgical Director for the Duke Center of Brain and Spine Metastasis. He's also an Assistant Professor at the Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Rory is a graduate of Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where he has obtained his MD and PhD in neuroscience, where he has also completed the neurosurgery residency program at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. Rory has a research interest in translational biomarkers and clinical outcomes for patients diagnosed with spinal tumors and genomic and proteomic predictors in brain and spinal oncology. Mrs. Andrea Godwin is a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Prior to beginning her doctoral studies, she earned a Master of Arts in Sociology at Morgan State University in 2011, as well as a Bachelor degree of Science and Master of Science in Exercise and Sports Sciences from the University of Florida in 2001 and 2003, respectively. Andy works to identify the association between race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status and gender and caregiving in the U.S. context. For today, we're discussing the idea that gender differences in health-related outcomes have been documented, revealing a concerning trend where women often encounter poorer outcomes and receive substandard care compared to their male counterparts. Despite this, the specific impact of gender on health-related quality of life and clinical outcomes following surgery remains ambiguous. A recent study proposed that gender could serve as a prognostic factor in both survival rates and clinical outcomes among patients undergoing treatment for spine metastasis, highlighting the necessity for tailored patient counseling. Yet, our comprehension of how individual patient characteristics influence these outcomes, including health-related quality of life and survival rates, remains inadequate and states ongoing investigation. Moreover, existing literature and population health studies underscore the variability of health outcomes based on socioeconomic factors, including but not limited to gender. These ingrained disparities in health-related outcomes underscore the urgency for further research and targeted interventions to address inequities in care provision. Today, we are discussing with Dr. Rory Godwin and Ms. Andrea Godwin about a newly published article with the title Gender and Sex Differences in Health-Related Quality of Life and Clinical Outcomes and Survival After Treatment of Metastatic Spine Disease. And this paper actually go a prospective study to discuss the different clinical outcomes and health quality of life outcomes between gender, female and males, in patients have been treated for metastatic spine disease. And actually want to reflect on the unconscious bias between the delivery of the healthcare services if there is a difference between female and males.
If I was just gonna give an idea of unconscious bias that comes into play with a woman patient is, you know, it dates back to when women were being diagnosed with hysteria, right? Like they come in and they present and they speak about what is ailing them. And historically, in medicine, it's been seen as being overblown, not necessarily accurate, speaking in hyperbole, whatever the case may be, and not given the full credence of let's respect what they're saying and let's see how we can treat that, right? That's just in general what we've seen historically in medicine. So that's an unconscious bias women are faced with whatever going into contact with the healthcare system. If we're looking at it more of an individual level, again, what a patient might be presenting as important and valuable to them and their expectation for what this procedure can or cannot do for them may not be something of value to the physician. When there's not concordance there within the physician and the patient, whether it be gender or class, then they may be saying, this is what I want to get back to. This is why I want to get this procedure. This is why this is important to me. And if the physician doesn't value that same thing, they may see that as trivial and not give it at least the respect to say, I'm sorry, that's not something realistically you can get back to, or sure, that's what we'll work towards. That's what we'll have as our goal. But the bias of what the physician brings into the table and then how that differs from what the patient is valuing can definitely play into the interaction and the communication that's happening between the two of them.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The unconscious bias, I think the best example of that is the Institute of Medicine's report on unequal treatment, where they had two actors basically go into emergency rooms with the same clinical story. The only difference between them was, one was male versus one was female, and they'd have heart attack symptoms. And basically, they would get very different treatment depending on whether it was a male or a female patient presenting with the same exact clinical history, the same exact testing, everything. And I think that unconscious bias is something that is associated with medicine just in general. I think that the part of kind of asking some of these questions delves into the fact that if we don't find out whether or not there are differences, we can't figure out ways to get better. We can't figure out ways of, hey, maybe there is an unconscious bias. Maybe there's a conscious bias, whatever is the case, but how can we make it so that way everybody gets as much benefit as possible from the things that we provide? And I think that's probably one of the things that is nice about this study is that it doesn't necessarily want to cause a big commotion, but it just wants to answer the question, introduce the concept, and try to figure out like, hey, is this something that's worth studying more? Is it something that, clinicians should take into consideration? Is it something that we should be looking into other factors associated with it? And I think more importantly, finding that there are differences, how can we then best like eliminate those differences so everyone basically gets, the maximal benefit from it?
Can you tell us in brief why the AO Knowledge Forum Tumor actually pursued the publication of this paper, especially about gender difference in the outcome?
Sure. I think, it's kind of similar to any question that the Knowledge Forum asks, especially the Knowledge Forum Tumor. We have, so many experts in spine oncology, and they're all dedicated to making sure that patients get the best outcome. And so from our standpoint as a group, we try to think of all of these different factors as, hey, how can we figure out what's the best way to do this? And so, whether it's a molecular marker, it's an EGFR inhibitor and how that actually alters treatment, or it's gender, or it's race, or it's basically whether you give this dose of radiation, don't want to leave any stone unturned when we think about how we think about disease, how we think about what's the best way to treat it, how we think about how we can provide patients with the best outcome. And so this is just along those lines, very, very similar in terms of thinking of just another factor that we can look at and see whether or not we can make a difference in that area.
What were the assumptions related to the gender-related outcomes before carrying out the data analysis in the current study?
Yeah, thank you. I think when you take the look at gender-related outcomes, the assumptions are that when you're considering outcomes based on the patient's reports or their ratings, such as health-related quality of life, the assumption is that women are going to fare worse, right? And that has a little bit to do with obviously diagnostic tools that have usually been set towards men. But also when you talk about the existing literature, it suggests that the major barriers for effective communication between a physician and a patient and their interactions are found within the differences for the patient and the physician as far as status, authority, education, things of that nature. So when the greater proportion of these surgeons are males in this particular field, then a woman coming into that interaction is going to probably have more of a barrier with the way things are communicated, what's understood about what needs to be done. And then when you look on the back end of that, when she's saying what the health-related quality of life is in the post-op report, that's not going to be as strong as a male patient when they're talking about their health quality of life afterwards.
And that's the same thing that's shown for other kind of social factors as well, right?
Sure. Like, yeah. When you look at it, the two groups that in society that have been identified as generally having the worst communication problems with their physicians are those who are lower class and those who are women. So you're seeing that when there are greater differences between the physician and the patient in these different statuses, then that's when there ends up being communication problems. And when I'm rating how my results are after an operation, my understanding of what I expected and then what I received is hugely based on the communication I have with the physician.
And I think that those expectations are really kind of based on, you know, that patient provider discordance and how you have two people who may not necessarily have the same background. You may have two people who basically have differences in their overall background, and that leads to a patient-physician or patient-provider discordance. And when that discordance occurs, I think that you have more likelihood that you're going to get certain things that are lost in translation. There may be a little bit of a misunderstanding, and that can be, you know, in any context. I think this is really just related more so to gender, but I think it, you know, is something that you can see across all the entire fields whenever we look at different groups.
Yeah, actually, that's a very interesting point and well illustrated. And I think all of us has experienced similar, let's say, loss in translation, as you just put it out. After conducting this study, it's mentioned that you did a sensitivity analysis before and after excluding gender-specific cancers, like breast cancer, uterus cancer, everything. If there is any notable differences in patient characteristics related to outcomes, especially regarding male and female gender?
So when we did the sensitivity analysis was really performed to kind of take out those gender specific cancers. So breast cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, those. And really it was basically because when you're thinking about gender, even though, you know, males can get breast cancer, we wanted to really look at the effect of gender when we looked at health related quality of life as opposed to sex, which is, you know, the difference of male and female. And so with that, you know, we found that basically there was a significant difference when you took out those gender specific cancers in terms of there were more smokers in the male and the men as opposed to women. There's also a significant difference in terms of the sites of the primary cancer. So lung cancer was actually higher in females when you took out those gender-specific cancers, and kidney cancer was the highest in males. I think in terms of outcomes, when you looked at that sensitivity analysis, even though everybody showed an improvement in surgery after surgery, in terms of looking at their health-related quality of life outcomes, whether it be EQ5D, pain scores, et cetera, just any of the kind of the tools that we usually use. When you did the sensitivity analysis, the thing that was interesting was that the significant improvement that you saw in terms of the physical health domains, the mental health domains, the social domains, those actually disappeared for females, meaning that overall, even though when you put everybody together, everyone benefited. When you took out all of those kind of gender-specific cancers, then basically you didn't see as much of a benefit for females. The other difference between it was that, you know, the females actually showed a lower complication profile and longer survival than males, meaning that even though they did not necessarily get as much benefit as their male counterparts in the sensitivity analysis, they actually had better outcomes overall in terms of survival and lower complications.
Yeah, and we had some interesting conversations with that after sensitivity analysis, because what I was seeing in that is when you took out those sex-specific cancers, now you're taking out the people who are used to dealing with women on the regular for every time they have a procedure, right? So if I'm used to treating people who have uterine cancer or breast cancer, and I'm used to communicating and setting a picture for women nonstop every time that's who's coming in as patients, then it's more likely that that communication has been set in a way that is clear to them and they understand what is the expectations are, and it's their perception of what they're getting as far as their quality of care is at the standard they would hope, right? But when you take those out, now you're having just surgeons who are speaking to males or females, depending on who the patient is, about whatever the cancer may be. And we're seeing now that the women aren't seeing that benefit anymore.
Yeah. And I think that's, I think that actually is a really good point as you think about it, because I think we did a recent kind of AO survey of spine surgeons. And when we did, we found that the majority of those are males. So if you think about that in that context, you know, whether it's an intrinsic and extrinsic factor, you know, whatever is the case, you know, there is a, there may be a difference in terms of how you counsel a patient that comes in with breast cancer if they're female versus their versus if it's a lung cancer, which you may have a different way of counseling for any patient because it's kind of agnostic, but that may not necessarily resonate with your female patients the same way that it does with your male patients, just because of the way that that cancer is in terms of their gender and kind of sexual identity or sex and gender identity, I should say.
And then again, sociologically, we are always looking at structure, right? So Rory made a great point about like the majority of those surgeons are males, but even the females who have been trained in that particular field are trained in the same type of structure as the males were. So even if they may be a female, their communication style might be of how to get this information across to the patient, the way that they've been trained. And that's been trained in a male-dominated field, with that being the lens of, with which the communication is coming from.
It's a very interesting point here. So actually, as you said, that it's not about the surgical management, it's not about the medical management, but about the communication, which should be different, or the approach would be different between male and female patients. That's what would make the difference?
That's part of the difference. But what I was trying to say there at the end is that, look, even a female surgeon communicating to a female patient in these male dominated fields, that female surgeon was trained in the same structure with which the male surgeons were as well. And that structure is for a male dominated field. So the communication style, what has been set as the standard and how you present information and options and things of that nature to your patients are the same for those surgeons. So as a woman coming into that as a patient, your perception could still be that you are not getting the respect and the communication and the clarity that you expect, even if you're having a female surgeon in that setting.
I think another way of kind of saying it is that I think, you know, in general, I think we have a lot of really, really great spine surgeons out there that basically are, you know, counseling every patient exactly the same in terms of how they train their future colleagues to do it, in terms of how they speak to patients, in terms of how they relay information. I think the difference, though, and kind of what you're getting at is that, you know, when that actual communication occurs, how the person across from you receives it is different based off of their overall background, whether that's they have a difference in being male versus female. And so if you've always kind of had, I should say always, but when you've had individuals that basically present it a certain way, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're giving care that is different to another person, but it's just saying that the person across from you is receiving it very, very differently. And that whole concept is kind of the expectation mismatch. And I'll give you an example. It's kind of like, you know, if my number one thing, you know, is cutting my grass, and I say that that's the most important to me, but yet I talk to a surgeon who basically doesn't necessarily cut their grass. And so is like, well, you know, if I don't bring up, you know, how is that affected? Or you tell me something that, oh, you can't bend or lift or twist for the next, you know, 6 weeks. And I'm going to be like, well, how am I going to cut my grass? Then at the end of the day, I'm going to have an expectation mismatch of what your surgery can actually accomplish for me, right? Even though you delivered the message the same exact way that you would for anybody. But at the end of the day, my receiving of that message is a little bit different.
Yes, make much sense, actually. And it's a very good point to raise, actually. But do you think, because this is a prospective study, Do you think there is, you know, usually prospective studies have some methodological limitations in conducting analysis of the data? Do you think that there is certain limitation with this study which might have influenced the interpretation of the results regarding gender-related outcomes regarding male and female, especially after removing gender-specific cancers?
For these studies, they're actually extremely hard to do for a couple of different reasons. I think one, and this is where I think AO and the Knowledge Forum, tumor specifically, and just all the Knowledge Forums are to be congratulated, is their ability to get like-minded individuals together so that way we can study these questions. I think that, you know, the downside of that is that, you know, we still have a long way to go in terms of combining all the data and getting all of the patient information. So for this study, you know, I think it was inadequately powered to answer the primary question. And I think that that, you know, means that basically a future study is going to probably have to be done to confirm whether or not this is actually something that is pervasive amongst all the patients. You know what I mean? I think secondly, you know, one of the things that's also hard is that, you know, with the patient population that's made up of spine metastasis, you know, the average survival of those patients is anywhere from 4 to 18 months. And so you can have a lot of patients that are lost to follow-up for various reasons. And so when you're looking at a health-related quality of life outcome, you have to realize that that is in the setting of patients with limited survival. So it's very hard to kind of get the real information that you want, which is, hey, at 6 months, at 1 year, you know, are these patients actually benefiting? And is there really a difference between the male and the female patients overall, kind of based on that? I think that that follow-up rate is going to be, you know, super, super important, because we know that, you know, for anybody who undergoes surgery, there needs to be a certain time that, you know, is the recovery period, that, you know, things are not necessarily going to be as beneficial for them in that preliminary 6 to 12 week period of time. But we know that after that, that's when they're going to get, you know, dramatic benefit from it. And that's when you see a lot of the studies that have shown that surgery is actually beneficial. I think the only other thing that I would say in terms of a limitation of this study as well, is that when you're looking at this, you know, we're really using kind of the gender specific cancers as kind of a proxy for, you know, the primary tumor versus, you know, the gender of the patient. And the best example of that can be, you know, when you think about breast cancer, like males can get breast cancer as well. And so I think that, you know, there may be some effects either with sex or gender that could be missing from this study. And those are things that I think we have to think about in the broader context in terms of any future studies in this arena.
Do you think that a more prospective study with a larger number of patients can either confirm or mitigate this effect?
I always think a larger study with more patients and kind of more robust analysis would definitely be better. But I think that one of the things that kind of goes with that is that you also have the possibility of other confounders. You know, in the U.S., we know that basically there are racial disparities that are associated with it. We know there are socioeconomic disparities associated with it. We know that, you know, insurance status, especially in the U.S., makes a difference. You know, we know education and your background make a difference in terms of it. And so one of the things that I think is super important, like you said, is having a larger study, because we need to basically take into account all of those different factors so we can figure out, you know, whether or not this is something different. And then, you know, start looking at the way that we think about everything from the tools we use to counsel patients, the way that we talk to patients, the things that we expect of them, the things that they expect of us. You know, there was a study that we did looking at patient expectations in these spine tumor patients, and there are some differences in it. And I think that overall, a larger study will help us to kind of confirm those things and try to figure out the best way to treat patients.
Hopefully this will happen soon. But back to the point, Andy, which you wrote about the difference in the expectation of patients depending on the message delivered to them preoperatively. Do you think how we can, let's say, include this point or this interest point of view in the further management for patients, female patients with cancers? Do you think that we have to change our healthcare regarding special message delivered to female and male patients different ways in different contexts?
I think there's always room for improvement, right? So we're training our physicians to be the best that they possibly can be, not only as surgeons, but also as far as communicators to the patients on what will be done, what can be expected, and trying to make that as clear as possible. Again, patients who come to you are most likely not surgeons, and they don't know what the outcome should be as far as their expectations. I'm trying to make that clear to them in a way that is congruent with their lifestyle, right? So Rory gave the example of like someone who cuts their lawn all the time. If that's something that's important to them and the surgeon is not aware of that, or it's not something that's spoken about, when they get back to life post-operative, are they able to go back to what they expected to do? If not, then they're not happy and they don't feel like they have that health-related quality of life in that respect that they thought they would, right? So to find ways that are able to allow our physicians to better counsel the patients on what to expect, what that looks like for their specific life, right? We were talking about gender today, but like all different statuses affect the way that a person perceives what is being communicated to them and what can be expected for them on the back end. So if I'm somebody who does more manual labor and that's what my life looks like, and you're counseling me as if I'm somebody who sits at a desk all day and works on a computer, then when I get back to my life and I'm not able to do certain things that I thought I should be able to do, because you said, yeah, you can get back to some work. Well, some work to me is not sitting at a desk. Some work to me might be pulling weeds in a yard. And so now me not being able to do that, then I feel like I haven't been given counseled correctly. I don't have the results I expected I would have. So I think the better we can prepare our physicians to be able to clearly communicate expectations to people and understand what those people's expectations are, right? Not everybody has the same expectations and not everybody has the same values of what they want to get back to. The closer we are to having concordance there, because we're not going to have necessarily concordance on all the different statuses, on gender, on education, on authority, on class, all those things. But if we can have more concordance on what is important to that patient, what their expectation is, then we can have more clarity. And I think that would show up better in those post-operative evaluations.
Andy, as a spine surgeon, what will be your advice to me, your recommendation to me? What, if there is anything which you can recommend that I can follow in my daily practice, me or my colleague, to decrease this disparity in the outcome between males and females?
Sure. I'm weekly in a seminar with clinicians, and I definitely recognize that the last thing that they want is to have more put on their plate. You guys are doing so much already. So that's not what we're looking to do here, right? There are small incremental changes that you can make just in the way that you approach and communicate things that can make it better for both you and your patients. And so thoughts about that would be, even if just a mental checklist, what is it that this patient is looking to get back to? Or what is it this patient values and finds important for them to be seeing this procedure as a success, right? For their health-related quality of life. Start there and work back. And even if the answer is like, sorry, that's not going to really be a possibility, at least now the expectation is set, right? We always talk about managing expectations. If I know that that's not something I'm going to get back to, that's better than thinking, oh, you said I could get back to work, or you said I could get back to what I normally do on a daily basis. But if you don't even know what I do on a daily basis, that's not true and clear to me. So I think the first place is to start at the end and start with what it is that this patient is hoping to gain, what it is that this patient is valuing as finding success in this procedure and making it that they are able to have a healthy quality of life after, for however long that might be. Rory has spoke about like how some of these timelines are quite short, but whatever they may be, what is it that they value and find as quality? So then you're able to clearly communicate to them an expectation on whether that's real or not, whether that's only partially a possibility for them. I think that when you talk about how women are maybe perceiving that they're getting less information, not clarity in what their expectations are, not necessarily the same standard of care, it's because there's a mismatch in what's being communicated from the physician, what they think they're communicating, and what is being received from the patient.
That's a very excellent tip, yeah. I think all of us should incorporate some of these questions during counseling the patient preoperatively. I think as surgeon, our main concern is about listing the complication, percentage of complication, what to expect in rehabilitation post-operatively, but digging deep in each patient person life, I think this will be a very good point to do, actually, to, as you said, to set proper expectation for each patient depending on his own lifestyle and own background culture. Yeah, I totally agree, and I'm happy to incorporate this in my daily practice, actually.
I would love to say that I came up with that idea because I do it all the time for my patients, but I think that you guys saw my secret sauce talking just recently.
Can you give us an example? For example, if you sit with when you're a patient in the clinic, how do you start into this introduction of this question with him or try the discussion with him?
You know, there's kind of three things that I usually try to do. I usually ask that patient, you know, what's their why, or kind of what are the what are kind of like two or three priorities that they are concerned about or that they're trying to get to. For some patients, that may be I'm trying to get to my sister's wedding so that way I can walk her down the aisle. For some people, it's, hey, my son is graduating and I basically want to be able to attend that. For some patients, it's I just want to be able to get out of bed and not be a burden to my family. And I think that, you know, all of those different things, I kind of have the patient set those expectations with me, and then based off of the imaging and all the clinical findings, you know, kind of have a discussion on terms of what's the likelihood of them getting to that specific thing, right? For some people, it may be gardening. For some people, it may be there. But how I've introduced it is that, you know, once I'm kind of go through the history, I basically ask them like, okay, well, what is it that you specifically want out of this, and what is your priority? And sometimes I even said it as, you know, what's your 1 week priority, your 1 month priority, your 3 month priority, your 1 year priority. And sometimes that gives me a better sense of how much do they understand their prognosis and basically accomplishing those goals within their timeline, especially since, like I was saying before, these patients have limited life expectancy. And I think it's important for them to kind of recognize that in the setting of their quality of life as well as their quantity of life.
Yeah, it will be very helpful to have this ahead before the surgery. Yeah. With the patients. And I think it will develop some sort of a personal relation between the physician and the patient himself. When the patient shares his expectations, his dreams, or his targets with the physician, it like create a bond preoperatively, I think, which can increase the trust and actually can be reflected on postoperatively, let's say, compliance to rehabilitation, compliance to the planned management plan between the physician and the surgeon, his patient, yeah.
That's a great point. You make a great point, because when the patient feels like they are working with the physician, there's more buy-in, right? Like, so the compliance for what is asked of them postoperatively, whether it's for rehab and things of that nature, there's more buy-in when they feel like these decisions were made jointly and that they're on the same page.
Yeah. Definitely.
And I also think, just to kind of add one other point to that, which is, it's been very, very valuable, I think, for me and for some of the patients I've treated, is it also makes it very clear the expectations to that patient for when they don't necessarily want to go through that process. You know, I think a lot of people view surgery as kind of like a one-time fix, but it's actually kind of the start of a process. You need physical therapy. You need to basically do, whether it's radiation treatment, whatnot. And so as you kind of set up those expectations for them and say, okay, to get to that goal, you will need to do this. You know, I've had some patients tell me, you know, I really don't want that. Like, I don't really want to go through that process that it's going to take through. As much as I love that hobby, like, it's not necessarily worth it as much for me, so to speak. And so they've decided that they didn't necessarily want surgery because of it. So I think that it kind of helps in both ways of try to setting expectations for if they you do have an intervention, but also letting the patient know, like, hey, this is what you would expect afterwards. So you may not necessarily want this moving forward, so to speak.
Okay, very well said, actually. I'd like to thank Dr. Rory Godwin and Mrs. Andy Godwin for their co-authoring this important article, actually, and pointing out that the findings actually can have some implication promoting diversity, equity, inclusion, the healthcare policy, and actual resources allocation related to the treatment of the spine disease. We hopefully that we can see some changes in delivering messages depending on male and females, and taking consideration, as we just very well said, about the different socioeconomic and gender background for each patient, which hopefully it will be reflected on a better clinical outcome and especially health quality outcome after intervention for spine metastasis. I'd like to thank you for having you today. It was a very informative discussion, actually interesting. As a spine surgeon, this point regarding disparity between delivering certain messages to different male and female, it actually, let's say it's new to me. And I'm happy that maybe later in my practice, I promote this to my colleague that will have to take more care of this point and hopefully to make a difference in the outcome of our patients. Thank you so much, Dr. Rory and Ms. Dandy. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. And thank you to AO Access.
Thank you for listening to the AO Access to Success podcast series.
Be sure to visit our webpage to facilitate your personal and professional development
by exploring dimensions of leadership
at AO Foundation, who we are, about AO Access,
to join the conversation.